The first reading comes from the book of Mark. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You also were with Jesus, the man from Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know or understand what you're talking about." And he went out into the forecourt. Then the cock crowed. And the servant girl, on seeing him, began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again, he denied it. Then after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them, for you're Galilean." But he began to curse, and he swore an oath, "I do not know this man you're talking about." At that moment, the cock crowed for the second time. Then Peter remembered that Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept.
The second reading is Joan of Arc by Leonard Cohen. Now the flames, they followed Joan of Arc as she came riding through the dark. No moon to keep her armor bright, no man to get her through this very smoky night. She said,
"I'm tired of this war. I want the kind of work I had before. A wedding dress or something white to wear upon my swollen appetite."
"Well, I'm glad to hear you talk this way. You know I've watched you writing every day, and something in me yearns to win such a cold and lonesome heroine."
"And who are you?"
She sternly spoke to the one beneath the smoke.
"Why, I'm fire,"
he replied.
"And I love your solitude. I love your pride."
"Then fire, make your body cold. I'm going to give you mine to hold."
Saying this, she climbed inside to be the one, to be his only bride. And deep into his fiery heart, he took the dust of Joan of Arc, and high above the wedding guests, he hung the ashes of her wedding dress. It was deep into his fiery heart he took the dust of Joan of Arc. And then she clearly understood, if he was fire, oh then she must be wood. I saw her wince, I saw her cry, I saw the glory in her eye. Myself I long for love and light, but must it come so cruel and oh so bright?
I have a memory of being maybe 6 or 7 years old, lined up with a bunch of other children at the back of our church, handed palms, and told that we were supposed to walk in down the center aisle and hold the palms high in our hands and wave them and sing the song that we'd rehearsed in Sunday school for the last 2 weeks. "Ride on, King Jesus." And so we did, and that was my memory of Palm Sunday. And every year, when we talk about ordering the palms, from an organic farm, by the way, I think of that memory as a child, and how I didn't know what it meant, and maybe still don't know what it means. But what I did realize at some point as an adult in preparing for Palm Sunday, that there was nothing about this occasion that felt joyous to me. And then I also began to have difficulty with this idea, even though we just sang it in our opening hymn, this idea of Jesus as a king. He wasn't a king. He wasn't a monarch. How do we make sense of this strange holiday that seems to celebrate death? I do remember saying something to my grandmother about this. Why is it called Good Friday, Grandma? It seems like it should be called Bad Friday. And she said, well, honey, that's because we know what's coming Sunday. And so it's really a Good Friday. And that seemed to satisfy my questioning at the time, but no longer. It's still a bad Friday, no matter what happens on Sunday, right? So let's talk about this. Let's talk about what this holiday really means. Some of you have heard this before, some perhaps not. But I want to unpack a little bit of history so you know the dynamics that occurred. Jesus was a peasant from Galilee, the northern sections, the sort of off-limit sections away from Jerusalem. He was, in that sense, an outsider, not part of that inner circle. And certainly as a peasant, wouldn't have been part of the well-connected. Those who were well-connected had an inside track with Rome. Rome was absolutely in charge of everything. There were provincial rulers in and around Jerusalem who were Jewish. And the Romans were pretty savvy in how they ruled different lands. They didn't go in and just replace everyone. They found those who could be opportunists and benefit from Rome. And so there were those like Herod and Herod's grandfather, who was also named Herod, that were part of those provincial rulers, Jewish rulers, but who were really more Roman than they were Jewish. We know people like that today, don't we? Those who play the system in such a way that they're unrecognizable to their own roots. That's what Herod was, and that's who many of the rulers were. Also, another dynamic that was going on is that there was an open rebellion happening for years and years, long before Rome even got in power. The previous rulers, the Greek rulers, the Seleucid dynasty from Syria, Antiochus IV, where we get that powerful story of Hanukkah. In all these times, there had been rebel Jews that said, no more. We will not take this. And the odds were against them. Rome covered a vast area, and these were just small group bands of people who believed in freedom. And they were what we would call today freedom fighters. And Rome had a particular form of execution for freedom fighters, and it was on the cross. And the cross didn't really look like we think of it as this tall thing like this. It was more flat on the top. And they usually didn't nail people to it, by the way. They tied them to it. And that was because they wanted them to die slowly. They would hang you just a little bit lower than you could really breathe. And so you'd have to pull yourself up to breathe. And of course, at that point where you could no longer pull yourself up, you suffocated and died. And they put these forms of execution all along the main roads so that anyone who walked in that direction would see what would happen if you became a rebel, if you became an insurrectionist as well. And so Jesus knew that as a Jew who was stepping into Pilate's arena, that he was putting himself in the same kind of predicament. The New Testament has a strange relationship with Jews and Romans. The New Testament, most of the Gospels, were written after 70. Remember, in the year 70, Judaism was in outright rebellion against Rome. From 63 to 73, a band of zealots tried to take over Rome in the land of Israel, and they were put down, and they were put down by a warrior who eventually became the Roman Empire himself, partly because of the success he'd had in and around that rebellion. And so the New Testament is written at a time when the Jews are in outright rebellion against Rome, and the church has become by this time almost exclusively Gentile, or not even Jewish anymore, a generation later. So the writers of the New Testament are writing in such a way as to put themselves apart from Judaism, saying, oh, we're not the Jews, we're not like those people. And it wasn't an outright, I don't believe, anti-Semitism, but it was a way to differentiate and say, we're not like that. The consequence, of course, is that the Jews are portrayed as the ones who crucified Jesus, when in fact, capital punishment was completely banned by the Romans for other groups. Only Rome could kill. Make no mistake. The Jews weren't the ones crucifying. They were the ones being crucified. And Pilate, crazy man that he was, he built 3 huge cities during his 10 years as the Roman procurator in Israel. He named all of them after Caesar. This man had ambition. Interestingly, we don't know what happened to him afterwards. He sort of disappears. But during that time, he crucified or beheaded more Jews than any other Roman provincial leader in a 10-year period in the history of the Roman Empire. This man did not wash his hands from the killings. He was the perpetrator of those killings. So we have this nonviolent peasant Jesus who decides to have a parade. Pilate came in from Caesarea by the sea, about 60 miles to the west of Jerusalem, on every Roman or every Jewish holiday. But this was no normal Jewish holiday. This was the Passover. And what does the Passover celebrate? The liberation of the Jews from Egypt. And they tell the story over and over again at the Passover of the Egyptians being washed away in the sea and them being set free. Whew! So Pilate rides in on his stallion with his whole army behind him, holding the Roman eagle high in the air from the west, saying, in this Passover celebration, don't think you can do this again, because you can't. I am in charge. Rome is in charge. So there's this little Galilean guy who's a peacemaker who walks around the area healing and listening and sitting with those who are on the margins and loving them, who talks about a different kingdom than the kingdom of Rome. And he's done this for about 3 years, and he decides that it's time to up the ante. And so while Pilate's riding in from the west on a stallion, Jesus finds a donkey or a colt and rides in from Bethany in the east on the same day. And instead of the Roman purple garments that they laid on the road to make it like a carpet for Rome to walk on, they didn't have those special garments, so they cut the branches, or so the story is told, from their trees and plants alongside the road, palms, and they made that into a carpet for this peasant king. Jesus knew what he was doing. He knew the result. Why would he do that if he knew that it would inevitably lead to his own death? I don't think we know the answer to that. I have some guesses. My thought is that he felt like it was time to up the ante for his followers, that there was only so much that he could say without really demonstrating a different kind of kingdom that pushed against Rome, and that he needed to demonstrate that even if it meant his own death. I don't think he wanted to die. Listen to the prayers that are said during the last week. Listen to the agony in the garden. This is not a man who wanted to die. This is a man who believed in a different kingdom than the Roman kingdom and knew that it would take the next generation of his followers to carry it on. And so in our scripture, we get an image of those followers today. Peter. Whew. What a piece of work. You think Jesus knew that? I bet he did. I bet he knew the kind of person that Simon Peter was. His name was Simon. He called him Peter, the rock. What a rock. More like sand. And so here he is confronted at the moment of identification, and he clearly identifies as someone who didn't know Jesus. And Jesus, the story is told him that that would happen. Now, I'm not sure that happened that way. But what's powerful for me about this story is that the church is telling this 40 years later. Peter, by this time, is the rock. He's carrying it on. And the church is telling this story about him denying Christ. What does that say? That tells you something about how they understood themselves, their own vulnerability, their own fear in the face of problems, and their own need to find a way to rise up in the midst of their own denials and become the rock themselves. Joan of Arc was one of those kinds of people. When she was on trial, they said, "How old are you?" And she said, "I think I'm about 19. She too lived in an occupied land in the area of Burgundy, which was in cahoots with England during the Hundred Years' War. Her little village wasn't. It was sort of a holdout for France. And when she was 12, she had a vision in her father's garden of three angels coming to her, Catherine and Michael, Dennis. They all came to her. And they said, you must support France. At least that's how she interpreted it. So this little girl, powerful, powerful little girl, tried to get an audience with the king to say, you need to sign me up. And the king ignored her. Finally, through hook and crook, she got an audience with the royalty. And they gave this little girl armor. And the legend is that she stepped into battle when others didn't. Now, history is a little different than myth. There's some that say she never actually fought herself. But there was the story going around, and we know this from writings that were happening at the same time, that she was in battle. And that inspired everyone. And so, whether she did or not, she created this sense of hopefulness that the way things are right now don't have to be the way they stay. And for a while, there was success. France pushed back the British and Burgundy forces. But eventually, she was caught and it was a big chess game of power, and she was a mere pawn in it. And she was put on trial. She wore a dress when she was in prison, but then petitioned to wear men's clothing again because she was afraid that she might be violated by someone. And so they gave her armor to wear even in jail. But when the trial came on and they couldn't find any real grounds of heresy, they found an angle to convict her. And that was that she had worn men's clothing in battle. And that, quoting the Summa Theologica of Aquinas from a few centuries earlier, was a heresy in and of itself, a violation of the natural order. And it was in that this 19-year-old girl, this 19-year-old warrior, this 19-year-old mystic and visionary was burned alive. And they say that she screamed out and cried, and some claim that she denied all of her visions in her burning. But most say that she didn't. She did cry, but she never denied. And she was eventually, in the early 1900s, made into a saint. My home church, hometown Catholic church, which was built in the 1920s, right after she was canonized, decided to name the church St. Joan of Arc. So, when I went to church with my best friend who was Catholic, I went to Joan of Arc Church. And remember the icon of her up on the wall that was so powerful. She didn't look 19 in that icon. She looked like she was the Queen of Heaven herself. That she was the warrior woman that we all needed to be. The story of Peter denying Jesus. I could tell you really, should I do this? I'm going to tell you a really funny story. And then I'll tell you a serious story. A bishop, Methodist bishop, was preaching on Peter denying the woman, denying Jesus before the woman. And he's preaching before a whole group of Methodists, packed house, and gets to the very heart of his sermon and says, "Can you just imagine that quivering Peter before the woman?" Total silence. And so he repeated himself, and the whole place burst into laughter. He never figured out what he'd said. After I heard that story in seminary, for years I always said Simon Peter anytime I was preaching on the apostle. But here's what I think about when I hear that story. I think about how, knowing my personality, I would not have been the one riding on the colt. I would have been the one hearing the rooster crow. When I was in junior high, a friend of my sister's was over at our house, and they were laying out in their bikinis in the yard, and a bunch of my friends were over there, most of them older, most of them bigger than me, and one of them said, "Let's go take the pants off of this girl." And I said, "No, we're not going to do that." And they did. Chased her down, pulled her pants off, and she cried. And I remember standing there, doing nothing, feeling ashamed, feeling embarrassed, feeling like I had let down my friend. But I said nothing. And every year in Lent, I would read this story about Peter and would feel the shame of my own silence as a 12-year-old. And so when Facebook came along, I found this person and I wrote her. And I said, I've been carrying this for 40 years. I want to apologize for not intervening. And she wrote back and said, you were a little kid. You couldn't have done anything. Don't worry about it. You should let that go. But even though it was freeing to hear her words of forgiveness, I knew that I didn't even try. And so I knew that she was wrong about me then. So the question is she wrong about me now? Where will I be on this journey to the cross? With whom do I stand? And how is that relevant in our own lives when we're called over and over again to speak against power, to stand up against the Rome that is in our own midst? Right on King Jesus. Pilate made a mockery of him, using the Latin word, Caesar of the Jews. Put that on the cross. Right on King Jesus wasn't a children's song, it turns out. It's an African-American spiritual. Ha ha ha. It was subversive. Just like Go Down Moses. Look at the author, Harriet Tubman. Woo! This wasn't about Moses going down to Egypt, was it? Mm-mm. Right on King Jesus. It wasn't about Jesus riding into Jerusalem. It was about the Spirit of God breaking into the institution of slavery and creating a different pathway. We wave our palms today, and that palm waving needs to carry that same spirit as right on King Jesus. In whatever way it confronts us in our own personal lives, in whatever way we need it to confront us systemically. That's what Palm Sunday is. And that's why I still hate this holiday and why it's absolutely necessary if we're going to have any theology of Easter. Amen.